Nikki, how much does she know? Astrid asked. About what?
About our family.
Not much. You're the only one she's met. She thinks you've got great taste in shoes and that your husband spoils you rotten. That's about it.
You probably want to prepare her a bit, Astrid said with a laugh.
What is there to prepare her for? Nick asked breezily.
Listen, Nikki, Astrid said, her tone getting serious. You can't just throw Rachel into the deep end like this. You need to prep her. Do you hear me?
Chapter 5. Astrid Leung, Paris. Every May 1st, the Lermet Pierres, one of France's great banking families, would host Le Bal de Muguet, a sumptuous ball that was the highlight of the spring social season. This year, as Astrid entered the arched passageway leading into the Lermet Pierres' splendid Hôtel Particulier on Île Saint-Louis, she was handed a delicate sprig of flowers by a footman in smart black and gold livery.
It's after Charles the Ninth, you know. He would present lilies of the valley to all the ladies at Fontainebleau every May Day, a woman wearing a tiara explained to her as they emerged into the courtyard where hundreds of miniature 18th-century hot air balloons floated among the topiaries. Astrid barely had time to take in the delightful sight when the Vicomtesse Nathalie de Lermet-Pierre pounced on her.
I'm so glad you could make it, Nathalie effused, greeting Astrid with quadruple cheek kisses.
My goodness, is that linen?
Only you could get away with wearing a simple linen dress to a ball, Astrid.
The hostess laughed, admiring the delicate Grecian folds of Astrid's buttercup yellow gown.
Wait a minute, is this an original, Madame Grey? Nathalie asked, realizing that she had seen a similar dress at the Musée Galliera.
From her early period, Astrid replied, almost embarrassed to have been found out.
But of course! My goodness, Astrid! You've outdone yourself once again. How on earth did you get your hands on an early gray?
Nathalie asked in awe.
Recovering herself, she whispered,
I hope you don't mind, but I have put you next to Grégoire. He is being a beast tonight as he thinks I am still fucking the Croatian. You are the only person I can trust next to him at dinner, but at least you'll have Louis on your left.
Don't worry about me. I always enjoy catching up with your husband, and it will be a treat to sit next to Louis. I just saw his new film the other day.
Wasn't it a pretentious bore? Hated the black and white, but at least Louis looked edible with his clothes off. Anyway, thank you for being my savior. Are you sure you have to leave tomorrow?
The hostess asked with a pout. I've been gone almost a month. I'm afraid my son will forget who I am if I stay one more day.
Astrid answered as she was ushered along into the grand foyer, where Nathalie's mother-in-law, the Comtesse Isabelle de Lermet-Pierre, presided over the receiving line. Isabelle let out a small gasp when she caught sight of Astrid.
Astrid! Quelle surprise!
Well, I wasn't sure that I would be able to attend until the last minute, Astrid said apologetically, smiling at the stiff-looking grande dame standing beside Comtesse Isabelle.
The woman did not smile back. Rather, she tilted her head ever so slightly as if appraising every inch of Astrid, the gigantic emerald earrings fastened to her long earlobe swaying precariously.
Astrid Leung? Permit me to present my dear friend, Baronne Marie-Hélène de la Durée.
The Baronne nodded curtly before turning back to the Comtesse and resuming their conversation. As soon as Astrid had moved on, Marie-Hélène said to Isabelle, sotto voce,
Did you notice that necklace she was wearing? I saw it at Jar last week. It's unbelievable what these girls can get their hands on nowadays. Tell me, Isabelle. Whom does she belong to?
Marie-Hélène, Astrid is not a kept woman. We've known her family for years.
Oh, who is her family?
Marie-Hélène asked in astonishment.
The Leungs are a Chinese family from Singapore.
Ah, yes. I've heard that the Chinese are getting quite rich these days. In fact, I read that there are now more millionaires in Asia than in all of Europe. Who would have ever imagined?
No, no, I'm afraid you don't quite understand. Astrid's people have been wealthy for generations. Her father is one of Laurent's biggest clients, Isabel whispered.
My dear, are you giving away all my secrets again?
Comte Laurent de la Mère Pierre remarked as he rejoined his wife in the receiving line.
Not at all. Merely enlightening Marie-Hélène about the Lyons,
Isabel replied, flicking away a speck of lint on her husband's grosgrain lapel.
Ah, the Lyons.
Why? Is the ravishing Astrid here tonight?
You just missed her. But don't worry.
You have all night to ogle her across the dinner table. Isabel teased, explaining to Marie-Hélène. Both my husband and my son have been obsessed with Astrid for years.
Well, why not? A girl like Astrid only exists to feed obsession,
Laurent remarked. Isabel smacked her husband's arm in mock outrage.
Laurent, tell me, how is it possible that these Chinese have been rich for generations?
Marie-Hélène inquired.
I thought they were all penniless communists in drab little Mao uniforms not too long ago.
Well, first of all, you must understand that there are two kinds of Chinese. There are the Chinese from mainland China who made their fortunes in the past decade, like all the Russians. But then there are the overseas Chinese. These are the ones who left China long before the communists came in many cases hundreds of years ago, and spread throughout the rest of Asia, quietly amassing great fortunes over time. If you look at all the countries in Southeast Asia, especially Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, you'll see that virtually all the commerce is controlled by the overseas Chinese, like the Liems in Indonesia, the Tans in the Philippines, the Leongs in... His wife cut in. Let me just say this. We visited Astrid's family a few years ago. You can't imagine how staggeringly rich these people are, Marie-Hélène. The houses, the servants, the style in which they live, it makes the Arnauds look like peasants. What's more, I've been told that Astrid is a double heiress. There's an even more enormous fortune on her mother's side.
Is that so?
Marie-Hélène said in astonishment, staring across the room at the girl with renewed interest.
Well, she is rather soignée, she conceded.
Oh, she's incredibly chic. One of the few from her generation who gets it right, the Comtesse decreed.
François-Marie tells me Astrid has a couture collection that rivals the Shaker of Qatar's. She never attends the shows because she loathes to be photographed, but she goes straight to the ateliers and snaps up dozens of dresses every season as if they were mackerel.
Astrid was in the salon admiring the Balthus portrait over the mantelpiece when someone behind her said, "That's Laurent's mother, you know." It was the Baronne Marie-Hélène de la Durée, this time attempting a smile on her tightly pulled face.
"I thought it might be," Astrid replied. "Chérie, I must tell you how much I adore your necklace. In fact, I had admired it at Monsieur Rosenthal's a few weeks ago, but sadly he informed me it was already spoken for." The Baron gushed. "I can see now that you were clearly meant to wear it."
"Thank you, but you've got the most magnificent earrings," Astrid replied sweetly, rather amused by the woman's sudden about-face.
"Isabelle tells me that you are from Singapore. I've heard so much about your country, about how it's become the Switzerland of Asia. My granddaughter is making a trip to Asia this summer. Perhaps you will be kind enough to give her some advice?"
"Of course," Astrid said politely, thinking to herself. Wow, it only took 5 minutes for this lady to go from snooty to suck up. It was quite disappointing, really. Paris was her escape, and here she strove to be invisible, to be just another of the countless Asian tourists who crammed eagerly into the boutiques along the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. It was this luxury of anonymity that made her love the City of Lights. But living here several years back had changed all of that. Her parents, concerned that she was living alone in a foreign city with no proper chaperone, made the mistake of alerting friends in Paris, like the Lermet Pierres. Word had gotten out, and suddenly she was no longer just the jeune fille renting a loft in the Marais. She was Harry Leong's daughter,
or Shang Su-yi's granddaughter.
It was so frustrating. Of course, she should be used to this by now, to people talking about her as soon as she left the room. It had been going on practically since the day she was born.
To understand why, one had to first consider the obvious, her astonishing beauty. Astrid wasn't attractive in the typical almond-eyed Hong Kong starlet sort of way, nor was she the flawless celestial maiden type. One could say that Astrid's eyes were set too far apart, and her jawline, so similar to the men on her mother's side, was too prominent for a girl. Yet somehow with her delicate nose, bee-stung lips, and long, naturally wavy hair, it all came together to form an inexplicably alluring vision. She was always that girl, stopped on the street by modeling scouts, though her mother fended them off brusquely. Astrid was not going to be modeling for anyone, and certainly not for money. Such things were far beneath her. And that was the other, more essential detail about Astrid. She was born into the uppermost echelon of Asian wealth, a secretive, rarefied circle of families, virtually unknown to outsiders who possessed immeasurably vast fortunes. For starters, her father hailed from the Penang Liangs, a venerable Straits Chinese family that held a monopoly over the palm oil industry. The Straits Chinese, also known as Peranakans, are the descendants of 16th century Chinese immigrants to the Malaya region. Often intermarried with the native Malays, they created a unique culture that is a hybrid of Chinese, Malay, English, Dutch, and Indian influences. They were the elites of Singapore, English-educated and more loyal to the British than to China. But adding even more oomph to Astrid's bloodlines, her mother was the eldest daughter of Sir James Young and the even more imperial Shang Su-yi. Astrid's Aunt Catherine had married a minor Thai prince. Another was married to the renowned Hong Kong cardiologist Malcolm Cheng. One could go on for hours diagramming all the dynastic links in Astrid's family tree, but from any angle you looked at it, Astrid's pedigree was nothing short of extraordinary. And as Astrid took her place at the candlelit banquet table in the Lerme Pierre's long gallery, surrounded by the gleaming Louis XV Sèvres and Rose Period Picassos, she could not have suspected just how extraordinary life was about to become. Chapter 6. The Chengs, Hong Kong. Most people driving past the squat grayish-brown building on a busy intersection of Causeway Bay would likely assume it was some sort of government health office, but the Chinese Athletic Association was actually one of Hong Kong's most exclusive private clubs. Despite its rather perfunctory name, it was the first Chinese-founded sports facility in the former British Crown Colony. It boasted the legendary gambling tycoon Stanley Lo as its honorary president, and its restrictive membership had an 8-year waiting list open only to the most established families. The CAA's public rooms were still firmly entrenched in late 70s chrome and leather decor, since members voted to spend all the money on updating the sports facilities. Only the acclaimed restaurant had been revamped in the last few years into a plush dining room with pale rose brocade walls and windows overlooking the main tennis courts. The round tables were strategically aligned so that everyone was seated with a view of the restaurant's main door, allowing its esteemed members to make a grand entrance in their après-sport outfits and making mealtimes a prime spectator sport. Every Sunday afternoon, the Cheng family would come together without fail for lunch at the CAA. No matter how busy or hectic the week had been, everyone knew that Sunday dim sum at the clubhouse, as they called it, was mandatory attendance by all family members who were in town. Dr. Malcolm Cheng was Asia's most esteemed heart surgeon. So prized were his skilled hands that he was famous for always wearing lambskin gloves, made specially for him by Dunhill, to protect his precious hands whenever he ventured out in public, and he took additional measures to safeguard them from the wear and tear of driving, opting instead to be chauffeured in his Rolls-Royce Silver Spirit. This was something his well-brought-up wife, the former Alexandra Alex Young of Singapore, felt to be overly ostentatious, so she preferred to call for a taxi wherever possible and allow her husband the exclusive use of his car and driver. After all, she was keen to say, he's saving people's lives every day, and I'm just a housewife. This self-deprecation was standard behavior for Alexandra, even though she was the true architect of their fortune. As a bored doctor's wife, Alexandra began channeling every cent of her husband's considerable earnings into properties just as the Hong Kong housing boom was taking off. She found that she had a preternatural talent for timing the market, so beginning in the oil recession days of the 70s, through the communist panic sell-off of the mid-80s and the Asian financial crisis of 1997, Alexandra was always snapping up properties when they hit rock bottom and selling at the peak. By the middle of the first decade of the new century, with Hong Kong property going for more money per square foot than anywhere else in the world, the Changs found themselves sitting on one of the largest privately held real estate portfolios on the island. Sunday lunch gave Malcolm and his wife a chance to inspect their children and grandchildren on a weekly basis, and it was a duty they undertook with utter seriousness. For in spite of all the advantages the Chang children had growing up, Malcolm and Alexandra were constantly worrying about them. Actually, Alexandra was the one doing most of the worrying. Their youngest son, Alistair, the hopeless one, was the pampered ne'er-do-well who had just barely scraped through Sydney University and was now doing something or other in the Hong Kong film industry. He had recently become involved with Kitty Pong, a soap opera star who claimed she was from a good Taiwanese family, even though everyone else in the Chang family doubted it, since her spoken Mandarin took on a distinctive northern China accent rather than the more cutesy inflections of Taiwanese Mandarin. Their daughter, Cecilia, the horsey one, had developed a passion for dressage at an early age and was constantly dealing with her temperamental horse or her temperamental husband, Tony, an Australian commodities trader whom Malcolm and Alexandra secretly nicknamed the Convict. A full-time mother, Cecilia actually spent more time on the international equestrian circuit than raising their son, Jake. Due to all the hours he spent with their Filipino maids, Jake was becoming fluent in Tagalog. He could also do a brilliant impression of Sinatra's My Way. And then there was Eddie, their firstborn. To all appearances, Edison Chang was the perfect one. He had breezed through Cambridge Judge Business School with distinction, done a stint at Cazenove in London, and was now a rising star in Hong Kong's private banking world. He had married Fiona Tung, who hailed from a politically connected family, and they had three very studious, well-behaved children. But privately, Alexandra worried the most about Eddie. In the last few years, he was spending far too much time hanging around with these dubious mainland Chinese billionaires, flying all over Asia every week to attend parties, and she worried how this might be affecting his health and his family life. Today's lunch was especially important, since Alexandra wanted to plan the logistics of the family trip next month to Singapore for the Koo wedding. It was the first time the entire family, parents, children, grandchildren, servants, and nannies included, was traveling together, and Alexandra wanted to make sure everything went off perfectly. At 1 o'clock, the family began filtering in from all corners. Malcolm from a mixed doubles tennis match, Alexandra from church with Cecilia, Tony, and Jake, Fiona and her children from their weekend tutors, and Alistair from rolling out of bed 15 minutes ago. Eddie was the last to arrive, and as usual, he was on his phone, coming to the table and ignoring everyone, chattering loudly in Cantonese on his Bluetooth earpiece. When he finally finished his call, he flashed his family a self-satisfied grin. "It's all sorted. I just spoke with Leo, and he wants us to use his family jet," Eddie declared, referring to his best friend Leo Ming. "For all of us to fly to Singapore?" Alexandra asked, a bit confused. "Yes, of course." Fiona raised an immediate objection. "I'm not sure that's such a good idea. First, I really don't think the entire family should be traveling together on the same plane. What would happen if there was an accident? Second, we shouldn't be asking such a favor of Leo."
"I knew you were going to say that, Fee," Eddie began. "That's why I came up with this plan. Daddy and Mummy should go a day earlier with Alistair. Cecilia, Tony, and Jake can fly with us the next day, and later in the day, the nannies can bring our children."
"That's outrageous. How can you even think of taking advantage of Leo's plan like that?" Fiona exclaimed.
"Fee, he's my best friend, and he couldn't care less how much we use the plane," Eddie retorted.
"What kind of jet is it? A Gulfstream? A Falcon?" Tony asked.
Cecilia dug her nails into her husband's arm, annoyed at his eagerness, and cut in. Why do your kids get to fly separately while my son has to travel with us? What about Kitty? She's coming too, Alistair asked quietly. Everyone at the table glared at Alistair in horror. Nechisana, Eddie snapped. You're out of your mind if you think you can bring someone like Kitty. Alistair was indignant. I already RSVP'd for her, and Colin told me that he couldn't wait to meet her. She's a big star, and I, in the new territories, maybe a couple of idiots watching trashy soap operas might know who she is, but trust me, nobody in Singapore has ever heard of her, Eddie cut in. That's not true. She's one of Asia's fastest rising stars, and that's beside the point. I want all our relatives in Singapore to meet her, Alistair said. Alexandra considered the implications of his declaration quietly, but decided to pick her battles one at a time. Fiona is right. We can't possibly borrow the Ming family plane 2 days in a row. In fact, I think it would look very inappropriate for us to fly in a private plane at all. I mean, who do we think we are? Daddy's one of the most famous heart surgeons in the world. You are Singaporean royalty. What's wrong with flying on a private plane? Eddie shouted in frustration, his hands gesticulating so wildly that he almost hit the waiter behind him, who was about to place a huge stack of bamboo steamers on the table. Uncle Eddie, look out! There's food right behind you, his nephew Jake shouted. Eddie glanced around for a second and continued on his tirade. Why are you always like this, Mummy? Why do you always behave so provincial? You are filthy rich. Why can't you be a little less cheap for once and have more a sense of your own self-worth? His three children looked up momentarily from their math practice test books. They were used to his rages at home, but had rarely seen him so upset in front of Gong Gong and Ama. Fiona pulled at his sleeve, whispering, Lower your voice, please. Don't talk about money in front of the children. His mother shook her head calmly. Eddie, this has nothing to do with self-worth. I just feel this sort of extravagance is completely unnecessary. And I am not Singaporean royalty. Singapore has no royalty. What a ridiculous thing to say. This is so typical of you, Eddie. You just want all of Singapore to know that you flew in on Ming Ka Ching's plane, Cecilia interjected, reaching for one of the plump roast pork buns. If it was your own plane, that would be one thing, but to have the audacity to borrow a plane for 3 trips in 2 days is just unheard of. I personally would rather pay for my own tickets. Kitty flies private all the time, Alistair said, though no one at the table paid him any attention. Well, we should get our own jet. I've been saying it for years. Dad, you spend practically half the month in the Beijing clinic, and since I plan to expand my presence into China in a big way in the coming year, Eddie began. Eddie, I have to agree with your mother and sister on this one. I just would not want to be indebted to the Ming family in this way, Malcolm finally said. As much as he enjoyed flying private, he could not stomach the thought of borrowing the Ming jet. Why do I keep trying to do this ungrateful family so many favors? Eddie huffed in disgust. Okay, you all do what you want. Squeeze into economy on China Airlines for all I care. My family and I are taking Leo's plane, and it's a Bombardier Global Express. It's huge, state of the art. There's even a Matisse in the cabin. It's going to be amazing. Fiona gave him a disapproving look, but he glared at her so forcefully that she retreated from any further objection. Eddie shoveled down a few rolls of shrimp chong fun, got up, and announced imperiously, I'm off! I have important clients to attend to! And with that, Eddie stormed out, leaving a rather relieved family in his wake. Tony, mouthful of food, whispered to Cecilia, Let's see their entire family plunge into the South China Sea on Liu Ming's fancy-ass plane. As much as she tried to, Cecilia couldn't stifle her laugh. Chapter 7 Eleanor, Singapore. After a few days of strategically placed phone calls, Eleanor finally nailed down the source of the disturbing rumor involving her son. Daisy confessed hearing it from her daughter-in-law's best friend, Rebecca Tang, who in turn revealed that she'd heard it from her brother, Moses Tang, who had been at Cambridge with Leonard Chang. And Moses had this to report to Eleanor. I was in London for a conference. At the last minute, Leonard invites me down to dinner at his country estate in Surrey. Have you been there, Mrs. Young?
Ayo, what a palace!
I didn't realize it was designed by Gabriel Hippolyte de Tellier, the architect who built Waterston Manor for the English Rothschilds. Anyway, we were dining with all these Angmore VIPs and MPs visiting from Singapore, and as usual, Cassandra Shang is holding court, and then out of nowhere, Cassandra says loudly across the table to your sister-in-law, Victoria Young, "You'll never guess what I heard. Nikki has been dating a Taiwanese girl in New York, and now he's bringing her to Singapore for the coup wedding." And Victoria says, "Are you sure? Taiwanese? Good grief, did he fall for some gold digger?" And then Cassandra says something like, "Well, it might not be as bad as you think. I have it on good authority that she's one of the Chew girls. You know, of the Taipei Plastics Chews. Not exactly old money, but at least they are one of the most solid families in Taiwan." Had it been anyone else, Eleanor would have dismissed all this as nothing but idle talk among her husband's bored relatives. But this came from Cassandra, who is usually dead accurate. She hadn't earned the nickname Radio One Asia for nothing. Eleanor wondered how Cassandra obtained this latest scoop. Nikki's big-mouthed second cousin was the last person he would ever confide in. Cassandra must have gotten the intel from one of her spies in New York. She had spies everywhere, all hoping to suck up to her by passing along some hot tip. It did not come as a surprise to Eleanor that her son might have a new girlfriend. What surprised her, or more accurately annoyed her, was the fact that it had taken her until now to find out. Anyone could see that he was prime target number one, and over the years, there had been plenty of girls Nikki thought he had kept hidden from his mother. All of them had been inconsequential in Eleanor's eyes, since she knew her son wasn't ready to marry yet. But this time was different. Eleanor had a long-held theory about men. She truly believed that for most men, all that talk of being in love or finding the right one was absolute nonsense. Marriage was purely a matter of timing, and whenever a man was finally done sowing his wild oats and ready to settle down, whichever girl happened to be there at the time would be the right one. She had seen the theory proven time and again. Indeed, she had caught Philip Young at precisely the right moment. All the men in that clan tended to marry in their early 30s, and Nikki was now ripe for the plucking. If someone in New York already knew so much about Nikki's relationship, and if he was actually bringing this girl home to attend his best friend's wedding, things must be getting serious. Serious enough that he purposely hadn't mentioned her existence. Serious enough to derail Eleanor's meticulously laid plans. The setting sun refracted its rays through the floor-to-ceiling windows of the recently completed penthouse apartment atop Cairnhill Road, bathing the atrium-like living room in a deep orange glow. Eleanor gazed at the early evening sky, taking in the colonnade of buildings clustering around Scotts Road and the expansive views all the way past the Singapore River to the Keppel Shipyard, the world's busiest commercial port. Even after 34 years of marriage, she did not take for granted all that it meant for her to be sitting here with one of the most sought-after views on the island. To Eleanor, every single person occupied a specific space in the elaborately constructed social universe in her mind. Like most of the women in her crowd, Eleanor could meet another Asian anywhere in the world, say, over dim sum at Royal China in London, or shopping in the lingerie department of David Jones in Sydney, and within 30 seconds of learning their name and where they lived, she would implement her social algorithm and calculate precisely where they stood in her constellation based on who their family was, who else they were related to, what their approximate net worth might be, how the fortune was derived, and what family scandals might have occurred within the past 50 years. The Taipei Plastics Chews were very new money, made in the 70s and 80s, most likely. Knowing next to nothing about this family made Eleanor particularly anxious. How established were they in Taipei society? Who exactly were this girl's parents, and how much did she stand to inherit? She needed to know what she was up against. It was 6:45 a.m. in New York. High time to wake Nikki up. She picked up the telephone with one hand, and with the other, she held at arm's length the long-distance discount calling card that she always used, squinting at the row of tiny numbers. Old-money Chinese like Eleanor absolutely loathed wasting money on long-distance telephone calls, almost as much as they hate wasting money on fluffy towels, bottled water, hotel rooms, expensive Western food, taking taxis, tipping waiters, and flying anything other than economy class. She dialed a complicated series of codes and waited for several beeping signals before finally entering the telephone number. The phone rang four times before Nick's voicemail picked up. "Hey, I can't come to the phone right now, so leave a message and I'll get back to you as soon as I can." Eleanor was always a little taken aback whenever she heard her son's American accent. She much preferred the normal Queen's English he would revert to whenever he was back in Singapore. She spoke haltingly into the phone. "Nikki, where are you? Call me tonight and let me know your flight information, la. Everyone in the world except me knows when you're coming home. Also, are you staying with us first or with Ama? Please call me back. But don't call tonight if it's after midnight. I'm going to take an Ambien now, so I can't be disturbed for at least 8 hours. She put down the phone and then almost immediately picked it up again, this time dialing a cell phone number. "Astrid, ah, is that you?"
"Oh, hi, Auntie Elle," Astrid said.
"You okay? You sound a bit funny."
"No, I'm fine. I was just asleep," Astrid said, clearing her throat.
"Oh, why are you sleeping so early? Are you sick?"
"No, I'm in Paris, Auntie Elle."
"Alamak, I forgot you were away. Sorry to wake you, la. How is Paris?"
"Lovely."
"Doing lots of shopping?"
"Not too much," Astrid replied as patiently as possible. Did her auntie really call just to discuss shopping?
"Do they still have those lines at Louis Vuitton that they make all the Asian customers wait in?"
"I'm not sure. I haven't been inside a Louis Vuitton in decades, Auntie Elle."
"Good for you. Those lines are terrible. And then they only allow Asians to buy one item. Reminds me of the Japanese occupation, when they forced all the Chinese to wait in line for scraps of rotten food."
"Yes, but I can sort of understand why they need these rules, Auntie Elle. You should see the Asian tourists buying up all the luxury goods, not just at Louis Vuitton. They're everywhere, buying everything in sight. If there's a designer label, they want it. It's absolutely mad. And, you know, some of them are just bringing it back home to resell at a profit."
"Yeah, la. It's those fresh-off-the-boat tourists that give us a bad name. But I've been shopping in Paris since the 70s. I would never wait in any line to be told what I can buy. Anyway, Astrid, I wanted to ask, have you spoken to Nikki recently?"
Astrid paused for a moment.
"He called me a couple of weeks ago."
"Did he tell you when he was coming to Singapore?"
"No, he didn't mention the exact date, but I'm sure he'll be there a few days before Colin's wedding, don't you think?"
"You know, la, Nikki doesn't tell me anything." Eleanor paused and then continued cautiously. "Hey, I'm thinking of throwing him and his girlfriend a surprise party. Just a small party at the new flat to welcome her to Singapore. Do you think that's a good idea?"
"Sure, Auntie Elle. I think they would love that."
Astrid was quite taken aback that her aunt was being so welcoming to Rachel. Nick must have really worked his charm overtime.
"But I don't really know what she would like, so I don't know how to plan this party properly. Can you give me some ideas? Did you meet her when you were in New York last year?"
"I did." Eleanor seethed quietly.
"Astrid was in New York last March, which meant this girl had been in a picture for at least a year now." "What's she like? Is she very Taiwanese?" she asked.
Taiwanese? Not at all. She seems completely Americanized to me," Astrid offered before regretting what she'd said.
How horrible, Eleanor thought.
She had always found Asian girls with American accents to be quite ridiculous. They all sounded like they were faking it, trying to sound so Angmo.
"So even though the family's from Taiwan, she was raised in America?"
"I didn't even know she was from Taiwan, to tell you the truth."
"Really? She didn't talk about her family back in Taipei?"
"Not at all." What was Auntie L getting at?
Astrid knew that her aunt was prying, so she felt like she had to present Rachel in the best possible light.
She's very smart and accomplished, Auntie L. I think you'll like her.
Oh, so she's the brainy type like Nikki?
Yes, definitely. I'm told she's one of the up-and-coming professors in her field.
Eleanor was nonplussed.
A professor? Nikki was dating a professor. Oh my, was this woman older than him?
Nikki didn't tell me what her specialty was.
Oh, economic development.
A cunning, calculating older woman a la muck. This was sounding worse and worse.
Did she go to university in New York?
Eleanor pressed on. No, she went to Stanford in California.
Yes, yes, I know Stanford, Eleanor said, sounding unimpressed. It's that school in California for those people who can't get into Harvard.
It's a top school, Auntie L, Astrid said, knowing exactly what her aunt was thinking.
Well, I suppose if you are forced to go to an American university... Come on, Auntie L. Stanford is a great university for anywhere.
I believe she also went to Northwestern for her master's. Rachel is very intelligent and capable and completely down to earth. I think you'll like her very much.
Oh, I'm sure I will, Eleanor replied. So her name was Rachel.
Eleanor paused. She just needed one more piece of information, the correct spelling of the girl's surname. But how was she going to get it without Astrid getting suspicious?
Suddenly, she had a thought.
I think I'm going to get one of those nice cakes from Awfully Chocolate and put a name on it. Do you know how she spells her surname? Is it C-H-U-C-H-O-O or C-H-I-U?
I think it's just C-H-U.
Thank you. You've been so helpful, Eleanor said. More than you'll ever know.
Of course, Auntie L. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help out for your party. I can't wait to see your spectacular new flat.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet? I thought your mother bought a unit here as well.
She may have, but I haven't seen it. I can't keep up with all my parents' property juggling.
Of course, of course. Your parents have so many properties around the world, unlike your poor Uncle Philip and me. We just have the house in Sydney and this small little pigeonhole.
Oh, I'm sure it's anything but small, Auntie L. Isn't it supposed to be the most luxurious condo ever built in Singapore?
Astrid wondered for the millionth time why all her relatives constantly tried to outdo each other in proclaiming their poverty.
No la, it's just a simple flat, nothing like your father's house. Anyway, I'm sorry to wake you. Do you need something to get back to sleep? I take 50 milligrams of amitriptyline every night and then an extra 10 milligrams of Ambien if I really want to sleep through the night. Sometimes I add a Lunesta, and if that doesn't work, I get out the Valium.
I'll be fine, Auntie L.
Okay then, bye-bye.
With that, Eleanor hung up the phone. Her gamble had paid off. Those two cousins were thick as thieves. Why didn't she think of calling Astrid sooner? Chapter 8. Rachel, New York. Nick brought it up so nonchalantly as he was sorting the laundry on the Sunday afternoon before their big trip. Apparently, Nick's parents had only just been informed that Rachel was coming with him to Singapore. And oh, by the way, they had just been made aware of her existence, too.
I don't quite understand. You mean your parents never knew about me in all this time? Rachel asked in astonishment.
Yes, I mean, no, they didn't. But you need to know this has absolutely nothing to do with you, Nick began.
Well, it's a little hard not to take it personally.
Please don't. I'm sorry if it seems that way. It's just that...
Nick swallowed nervously.
It's just that I've always tried to keep clear boundaries between my personal life and my family life, that's all.
But shouldn't your personal life be the same as your family life?
Not in my case.
Rachel, you know how overbearing Chinese parents can be.
Well, yeah, but it still wouldn't keep me from telling my mom about something as important as my boyfriend. I mean, my mom knew about you 5 minutes after our first date, and you were sitting down to dinner with her, enjoying her winter melon soup, like 2 months later.
Well, You have a very special thing with your mum. You know that. It's not that easy for most other people. And with my parents, it's just... Nick paused, struggling for the right words. We're just different. We're much more formal with each other, and we don't really discuss our emotional lives at all. What, are they cold and emotionally shut down or something? Did they live through the Great Depression? Nick laughed, shaking his head. No, nothing like that. I just think you'll understand when you meet them. Rachel didn't know what to think. Sometimes Nick could be so cryptic, and his explanation made no sense to her. Still, she didn't want to overreact. Anything else you want to tell me about your family before I get on a plane and spend the whole summer with you? No, not really. Well, Nick paused for a bit, trying to decide if he should mention the housing situation. He knew he had screwed things up royally with his mother. He had waited too long, and when he called to break the news officially about his relationship with Rachel, his mother had been silent. Ominously silent. All she asked was, "So where will you be staying, and where will she be staying?" It suddenly dawned on Nick that it would not be a good idea for the both of them to stay with his parents. Not initially, at least. Nor would it be appropriate for Rachel to stay at his grandmother's house without her explicit invitation. They could stay with one of his aunts or uncles, but that might incite his mother's wrath and create even more of an internecine war within his family. Not sure how to get out of this quagmire, Nick sought the counsel of his great-aunt, who was always so good at sorting out these sorts of matters. Great-aunt Rosemary advised him to book into a hotel first, but emphasized that he must arrange to introduce Rachel to his parents on the day of his arrival.
"The very first day. Don't wait until the next day," she cautioned.
Perhaps he should invite his parents out to a meal with Rachel, so they could meet on neutral territory. Someplace low-key, like the Colonial Club, and better to make it lunch instead of dinner.
"Everyone is more relaxed at lunchtime," she advised.
Nick was then to proceed to his grandmother's by himself and formally request permission to invite Rachel to the customary Friday night dinner that Ama hosted for the extended family. Only after Rachel had been properly received at Friday night dinner should the topic of where they might stay be broached. "Of course, your grandmother will have you to stay once she meets Rachel. But if worst comes to worst, I will invite you to stay with me, and no one will be able to say anything then," Great Aunt Rosemary assured him. Nick decided to keep these delicate arrangements from Rachel. He didn't want to give her any excuse to back out of the trip. He wanted Rachel to be prepared to meet his family, but he also wanted her to create her own impressions when the time came. Still, Astrid was right. Rachel needed some sort of primer on his family. But how exactly could he explain his family to her, especially when he had been conditioned his whole life never to speak about them? Nick sat on the floor, leaning against the exposed brick wall and putting his hands on his knees.
"Well, you probably should know that I come from a very big family."
"I thought you were an only child."
"Yes, but I have lots of extended relatives, and you'll be meeting lots of them. There are 3 intermarried branches, and to outsiders it can seem a bit overwhelming at first."
He wished he hadn't used the word outsiders as soon as he said it, but Rachel seemed not to notice, so he continued.
"It's like any big family. I have loudmouth uncles, eccentric aunts, obnoxious cousins, the whole 9 yards. But I'm sure you'll get a kick out of meeting them. You met Astrid, and you liked her, didn't you?"
"Astrid is awesome."
"Well, she adores you. Everyone will adore you, Rachel. I just know it."
Rachel sat quietly on the bed beside the pile of towels still warm from the dryer, trying to soak in everything Nick had said. This was the most he had ever talked about his family, and it made her feel a little more assured. She still couldn't quite fathom the deal with his parents, but she had to admit that she had seen her fair share of distant families, especially among her Asian friends. Back in high school, she had endured dreary meals in the fluorescent-lit dining rooms of her classmates, dinners where not more than 5 words were exchanged between parent and child. She had noticed the stunned reactions from her friends whenever she randomly hugged her mother or said, "I love you," at the end of a phone call. And several years ago, she had been emailed a humorous list entitled, 20 Ways You Can Tell You Have Asian Parents. Number 1 on the list, your parents never, ever call you just to say hello. She didn't get many of the jokes on the list since her own experience growing up had been entirely different.
We're so fortunate, you know. Not many mother and daughters have what we have,
Carrie said when they caught up on the phone later that evening. I realize that, Mom. I know it's different because you were a single mom and you took me everywhere, Rachel mused. Back when she was a child, it seemed like every year or so her mother would answer a classified ad in World Journal, the Chinese American newspaper, and off they would go to a new job in some random Chinese restaurant in some random town. Images of all those tiny boarding house rooms and makeshift beds in cities like East Lansing, Phoenix, and Tallahassee flashed through her head.
You can't expect other families to be like us. I was so young when I had you, 19. We were able to be like sisters. Don't be so hard on Nick. Sad to say, but I was never very close to my parents either. In China, there was no time to be close. My mother and father worked from morning till night, 7 days a week, and I was at school all the time.
Still, how can he hide something as important as this from his parents? It's not like Nick and I have only been going out for a couple of months.
Daughter, once again, you are judging the situation with your American eyes. You have to look at this the Chinese way. In Asia, there is a proper time for everything, a proper etiquette. Like I said before, you have to realize that these overseas Chinese families can be even more traditional than we mainland Chinese. You don't know anything about Nick's background. Has it occurred to you that they might be quite poor? Not everyone is rich in Asia, you know. Maybe Nick has a duty to work hard and send money back to his family, and they wouldn't approve if they thought he was wasting money on girlfriends. Or maybe he didn't want his family to know that the two of you spent half the week living together. They could be devout Buddhists, you know.
That's just it, Mom. It's dawning on me that Nick knows everything there is to know about me, about us, but I know almost nothing about his family.
Don't be scared, daughter. You know Nick. You know he is a decent man. And though he may have kept you secret for a while, he is doing things the honorable way now. At last, he feels ready to introduce you to his family. Properly. And that is the most important thing, Carrie said.
Rachel lay in bed, calmed as always by her mother's soothing Mandarin tones. Maybe she was being too hard on Nick. She had let her insecurities get the better of her, and her knee-jerk reaction was to assume that Nick waited so long to tell his parents because he was somehow embarrassed about her. But could it be the other way around? Was he embarrassed of them? Rachel remembered what her Singaporean friend Paik Lin had said when she Skyped her and excitedly announced that she was dating one of her fellow countrymen. Paik Lin came from one of the island's wealthiest families, and she had never heard of the Youngs.
Obviously. If he comes from a rich or prominent family, we would know them. Young isn't a very common name here. Are you sure they're not Korean?
Yeah, I'm sure they're from Singapore. But, you know, I couldn't care less how much money they have.
Yes, that's the problem with you, Paik Lin cracked. Well, I'm sure if he passed the Rachel Chu test, his family is perfectly normal.
Chapter 9 Astrid, Singapore. Astrid arrived home from her Paris sojourn in the late afternoon, early enough to give 3-year-old Cassian his bath, while Evangeline, his French au pair, looked on disapprovingly. Maman was scrubbing his hair too forcefully and wasting too much baby shampoo. After tucking Cassian into bed and reading him Bonsoir Lune, Astrid resumed the ritual of carefully unpacking her new couture acquisitions and hiding them away in the spare bedroom before Michael got home. She was careful never to let her husband see the full extent of her purchases every season. Poor Michael seemed so stressed out by work lately. Everyone in the tech world seemed to work such long hours, and Michael and his partner at Cloud9 Solutions were trying so hard to get this company off the ground. He was flying to China almost every other week these days to supervise new projects, and she knew he would be tired tonight since he had gone straight to work from the airport. She wanted everything to be perfect for him when he walked through the door. Astrid popped into the kitchen to chat with her cook about the menu and decided they should set up dinner on the balcony tonight. She lit some fig apricot-scented candles and set a bottle of the new Sauternes she had brought back from France in the wine chiller. Michael had a sweet tooth when it came to wines, and he had taken a liking to late harvest Sauternes. She knew he was going to love this bottle, which had been specially recommended to her by Manuel, the brilliant sommelier at Taillevaux. To the majority of Singaporeans, it would seem that Astrid was in store for a lovely evening at home. But to her friends and family, Astrid's current domestic situation was a perplexing one. Why was she popping into kitchens, talking to cooks, unpacking luggage by herself, or worrying about her husband's workload? This was certainly not how anyone would imagine Astrid's life to be. Astrid Leung was meant to be the chatelaine of a great house. Her head housekeeper should be anticipating every one of her needs, while she should be getting dressed up to go out with her powerful and influential husband to any one of the exclusive parties being thrown around the island that night. But Astrid always confounded everyone's expectations. For the small group of girls growing up within Singapore's most elite milieu, life followed a prescribed order. Beginning at age 6, you were enrolled at Methodist Girls' School, MGS, Singapore Chinese Girls' School, SCGS, or the Convent of the Holy Infant Jesus, CHIJ. After-school hours were consumed by a team of tutors preparing you for the avalanche of weekly exams, usually in classical Mandarin literature, multivariable calculus, and molecular biology, followed on the weekends by piano, violin, flute, ballet, or writing, and some sort of Christian youth fellowship activity. If you did well enough, you entered the National University of Singapore, NUS, and if you did not, you were sent abroad to England. American colleges were deemed substandard. The only acceptable majors were medicine or law, unless you were truly dumb, in which case you settled for accounting. After graduating with honors, anything less would bring shame to the family. You practiced your vocation for not more than 3 years before marrying a boy from a suitable family at the age of 25, 28 if you went to med school. At this point, you gave up your career to have children. 3 or more were officially encouraged by the government for women of your background, and at least 2 should be boys. And life would consist of a gentle rotation of galas, country clubs, Bible study groups, light volunteer work, contract bridge, mahjong, traveling, and spending time with your grandchildren, dozens and dozens, hopefully, until your quiet and uneventful death. Astrid changed all this. She wasn't a rebel, because to call her one would imply that she was breaking the rules. Astrid simply made her own rules, and through the confluence of her particular circumstances, a substantial private income, overindulgent parents, and her own savoir-faire, every move she made became breathlessly talked about and scrutinized within that claustrophobic circle. In her childhood days, Astrid always disappeared from Singapore during the school holidays. And though Felicity had trained her daughter never to boast about her trips, a schoolmate invited over had discovered a framed photo of Astrid astride a white horse with a palatial country manor as a backdrop. Thus began the rumor that Astrid's uncle owned a castle in France, where she spent all her holidays riding a white stallion. Actually, it was a manor in England. The stallion was a pony, and the schoolmate was never invited again. In her teen years, the chatter spread even more feverishly when Celeste Ting, whose daughter was in the same Methodist Youth Fellowship group as Astrid, picked up a copy of Point de Vue at Charles de Gaulle Airport and came upon a paparazzi photograph of Astrid doing cannonballs off a yacht in Porto Ercole with some young European princes. Astrid returned from school holidays that year with a precociously sophisticated sense of style. While other girls in her set became mad for head-to-toe designer brands, Astrid was the first to pair a vintage Saint Laurent Le Smoking jacket with $3 batik shorts bought off a beach vendor in Bali, the first to wear the Antwerp 6, and the first to bring home a pair of red-heeled stilettos from some Parisian shoemaker named Christian. Her classmates at Methodist Girls' School strove to imitate her every look, while their brothers nicknamed Astrid the Goddess and anointed her the chief object of their masturbatory fantasies. After famously and unabashedly flunking every one of her A-levels, how could that girl concentrate on her studies when she was jet-setting all the time? Astrid was shipped off to a preparatory college in London for revision courses. Everyone knew the story of how 18-year-old Charlie Wu, the eldest son of the tech billionaire Wu Haolian, bade a tearful goodbye to her at Changi Airport and promptly chartered his own jet, ordering the pilot to race her plane to Heathrow. When Astrid arrived, she was astonished to find a besotted Charlie awaiting her at the arrival gate with 300 red roses. They were inseparable for the next few years, and Charlie's parents purchased a flat for him in Knightsbridge for the sake of appearances, even though the cognoscenti suspected Charlie and Astrid were probably living in sin at her private quarters in the Cawthorpe Hotel. At age 22, Charlie proposed on a ski lift in Verbier, and though Astrid accepted, she supposedly refused the 39-carat diamond solitaire he presented as far too vulgar. Flinging it onto the slopes, Charlie did not even attempt to search for the ring. Social Singapore was a-twitter over the impending nuptials, while her parents were aghast at the prospect of becoming connected to a family of no particular lineage and such shameless new money. But it all came to a shocking end 9 days before the most lavish wedding Asia had ever seen, when Astrid and Charlie were sighted having a screaming match in broad daylight. Astrid, it was famously said, chucked him, like she chucked that diamond, outside Wendy's on Orchard Road, throwing a Frosty in his face, and took off for Paris the next day. Her parents supported the idea of Astrid having a cooling-off period away. But try as she might to maintain a low profile, Astrid effortlessly enchanted Le Tout Paris with her smoldering beauty. Back in Singapore, the wagging tongues resumed. Astrid was making a spectacle of herself. She was supposedly spotted in the front row at the Valentino show, seated between Joan Collins and Princess Rosario of Bulgaria. She was said to be having long, intimate lunches at Le Voltaire with the married philosopher Playboy. And perhaps most sensational, rumor had it that she had become involved with one of the sons of the Aga Khan and was preparing to convert to Islam so that they could marry. The Bishop of Singapore was said to have flown to Paris on a moment's notice to intervene. All these rumors came to naught when Astrid surprised everyone again by announcing her engagement to Michael Teo. The first question on everyone's lips was, Michael who? He was a complete unknown, the son of schoolteachers from the then middle-class neighborhood of Tua Payo. At first, her parents were aghast and mystified by how she could have come into contact with someone from that kind of background. But in the end, they realized that Astrid had made something of a catch. She had chosen a fiercely handsome armed forces elite commando who was a national merit scholar and a Caltech-trained computer systems specialist. It could have been much worse. The couple married in a very private, very small ceremony, only 300 guests at her grandmother's house, that garnered a pictureless 51-word announcement in the Straits Times, even though there were anonymous reports that Sir Paul McCartney flew in to serenade the bride at a ceremony that was exquisite beyond belief. Within a year, Michael left his military post to start his own tech firm, and the couple had their first child, a boy they named Cassian. In this cocoon of domestic bliss, one might have thought that all the stories involving Astrid would simmer down. But the stories were not about to end. A little after 9, Michael arrived home, and Astrid rushed to the door, greeting him with a long embrace. They had been married for more than 4 years now, but the sight of him still sent an electric spark through her, especially after they had been apart for a while. He was just so startlingly attractive, especially today with his stubble and the rumpled shirt that she wanted to bury her face in. Secretly, she loved the way he smelled after a long day. They had a light supper of steamed whole pomfret in a ginger wine sauce and clay pot rice, and stretched out on the sofa afterward, buzzed from the 2 bottles of wine they had polished off. Astrid continued to recount her adventures in Paris, while Michael stared zombie-like at the sports channel on mute. "Did you buy many of those $1,000 dresses this time?" Michael inquired. "No, just one or two," Astrid said breezily, wondering what would happen if he ever realized that $200,000 per dress was more like it. "You're such a bad liar," Michael grunted. Astrid nestled her head on his chest, slowly stroking his right leg. She brushed the tips of her fingers in one continuous line, tracing his calf, up the curve of his knee, and along the front of his thigh.